it could potentially destroy all of his investments. Without the power that came with his office, he would be worthless to his partners. The long list of enemies that he'd made over the years would think nothing of coming after him. His hand started to shake. Fietz finally asked, "How much money?" Ivanov had to take another drink to gain the courage to speak the number. $26 million, roughly. And it belonged to... It took Ivanov a moment to answer. Our friends in Beirut. Fietz thought of the different militant terrorist groups. Their money or ours?
Both.
Both? Yes. Think of it as a joint venture. We invested money with those zealots? Fietz asked, not bothering to hide his surprise.
It's control, you idiot!
I don't even know why I bother explaining sometimes. We put in money so we would have a say in how it was used. Think of it as foreign aid. It was more complicated than that, but Ivanov didn't have the time or clarity of mind to explain the complicated arrangement this morning, or the fact that approximately 10 million of it was KGB money that had been siphoned off over the years. Foreign aid to terrorists? Lovely. Stop with your judgments, you know nothing. They put money in the accounts as well. In fact, most of it was theirs. Ivanov had helped them find new revenue streams by peddling black market items such as drugs, guns, and porn. The drugs and guns were shipped all over the Middle East and North Africa, and the porn was smuggled into Saudi Arabia. If the majority of the money was theirs, why did we have control of it? Ivanov gave an exasperated sigh as it occurred to him that he would have to go upstairs and tell the director. He tolerated these side business deals, but only to a point. This he would not like very much. In fact, there would be a great deal of suspicion that Ivanov had stolen the money for himself, if for no other reason than that they could all imagine themselves doing it. Fietz repeated his question, and Ivanov said, "It was part of the deal. If they wanted our help, we wanted to know what they were doing with it, and we wanted them to put their own funds in as well." It was only a half-truth, but Ivanov did not feel the need to go into details with one of his deputies. "I'm assuming the 26 represents the bulk of their assets?"
"Yes."
Ivanov took another gulp. The vodka was starting to lubricate the gears in his brain. He began to make a list in his head of who he would need to talk to.
"Who had access to the account information and passcodes?"
"They did and I did.
Any withdrawal of more than 25,000 had to be authorized by each of us separately."
"So you had one passcode and they had the other?"
"Yes."
Fietz was asking too many questions. "Who had access to both sets of passcodes?"
"No one."
The headache was starting to come back, although this time it was in his neck. He began rubbing the muscles with his left hand while he took another drink of vodka.
"It was intentionally set up so that neither party would have both passcodes."
Fietz considered that for a moment and then said,
"Someone had to have both codes. Someone at the bank. How else could the codes be verified and the money moved?"
Ivanov stopped rubbing his neck. Why hadn't he come to the same conclusion sooner?
"Dorfman."
"Who?"
"The banker."
Ivanov looked up Dorfman's office number and punched it in as fast as his fingers could move. It took more than 2 minutes, 3 people, and a string of threats to get an answer that told him things were not good. Dorfman had not shown up for work, and they had been unable to reach him. Ivanov hung up the phone and laid his head down on the desk. Fietz opened the office door and asked the secretary to bring them coffee. He then walked over to the desk and took the glass of vodka. Ivanov tried to stop him.
"This is not helping," Fietz said in a paternal voice. "I am tied to you whether I like it or not. And if we are going to avoid being interrogated by our colleagues in the Federal Security Service, we need to clear your head and get you thinking straight."
Ivanov's entire body shuddered at the thought of the FSS goons dragging him into the basement of Lubyanka, the once feared grand headquarters of the KGB. He knew all too well what went on in those prison cells in the basement. And he would kill himself before he ever allowed that to happen. Chapter 34. Southern Germany.
The trip was uneventful, in the sense that they pointed the hood of the big Mercedes south and stopped only twice before reaching the Swiss-German border. For 8 hours they cruised at an average speed of 120 kilometers an hour down the smooth, twisting Autobahn. Near some of the larger towns they had to slow, and when they neared the mountains to the south, the winding, rising road slowed their progress only slightly. They were thankful that there was no snow. They skirted Hanover, Kassel, Frankfurt, Strasbourg, and a blur of other towns, while Hurley pored over the treasure trove of information he'd retrieved from the banker's safe. Richards fired up the laptop and used the decoding software to uplink the information on Dorfman's disks via the satellite phone. Kennedy had a team assembled in D.C. who were translating and filtering the information. Richards was done sending the information by the time they reached Kassel. He slept for the next 2 hours. Rapp listened to the snippets of conversation coming from the back seat and wondered what the next move would be. Hurley liked to operate on a strictly need-to-know basis, and Rapp and Richards rarely needed to know, at least as far as Hurley was concerned. Halfway through the trip, Hurley ordered Rapp to pull over and switch with Richards. They topped off the gas, used the men's room, and Hurley bought coffee and some snacks for him and Richards. Rapp didn't mind driving, but Hurley was insistent. An hour or two of downtime was crucial. One never knew when things would get interesting. As was often the case, though, Hurley did not listen to his own advice and continued to work at a feverish pace. Rapp climbed into the back seat, and after a few minutes of silence he asked Hurley, "What are we doing?" Uncharacteristically, Hurley laughed. "I'll explain before we cross the border. Right now, I need to figure this shit out." It occurred to Rapp that the man was punch drunk, but he didn't dwell on it. Within minutes, the hum of the tires rolling at high speed on the concrete surface of the Autobahn sent Rapp into a trance. He rolled up his jacket, wedged it in between the door frame and his head, and fell asleep. For the next few hours, he drifted in and out of sleep, the shrill ring of the satellite phone interrupting dreams of poodles, bad comb-over hairdos, and trussed-up, plump German women. At one point he was drifting off to sleep and wondered what Frau Dorfman would do with the dogs now that her husband was not of this world. For some reason that made him think of the expanding pool of blood under Dorfman's head. How far had it stretched? Would it begin to dry in the arid winter air? How much blood was actually in a human head? 1 pint? Before he could decide on an amount, he drifted off. Hurley never slowed. He reviewed every document, every file, post-it note, and receipt. He'd filled close to an entire notepad with the most pertinent information. At 5 a.m., they stopped at a roadside motel outside Freiburg and got 2 connecting rooms, where they cleaned up and changed into suits and ties for the border crossing. Hurley ordered them to pack their weapons in the hidden compartments inside their suitcases. By 6, they were back on the road with fresh coffee and rolls, and Hurley was ready to explain what they were doing. Unfortunately, he chose the wrong military campaign to illustrate his point. "You too familiar with Sherman's March to the Sea?" Rapp was behind the wheel. Having been raised in Northern Virginia, he didn't really consider himself a Southerner, but he was a proud Virginian, and that meant he knew his Civil War history. To a true Southerner like Richards, who had been raised in Covington, Georgia, the mere mention of William Tecumseh Sherman was enough to start a fight. "Total war," Hurley said, "just like Sherman. If our enemy won't come out and meet us on the field of battle, we need to bring the war to their doorstep. We need to destroy their capacity to fight. We need to spook them into maneuvering in the open so we can crush them." Rapp could see both men's faces in the rearview mirror. Hurley was oblivious to the revulsion on Richard's face. "Are you trying to tell me," Richard said, "that we're Sherman?"
"I sure as hell hope so," said Hurley, in a state of near elation. "He won, didn't he?"
Rapp couldn't take it anymore and started laughing.
"What the hell's so funny?" Hurley asked.
When he got control of himself, he said, "You're sitting next to one of Georgia's finest. It's like singing the praises of Andrew Jackson to a bunch of Indians."
"Oh," Hurley said, as he realized his mistake. "No offense intended. We'll have to debate that one over beers one night. Sherman was a badass."
Throwing him a bone, he added, "And Lee and Jackson were 2 battlefield geniuses, can't deny that." Then he changed tactics and asked, "You've hunted birds, right?"
"Yeah."
"Why do you bring a dog into the field?"
to get the birds up.
Exactly, Hurley said. These guys have done a damn good job keeping their heads down the past 10 years while Langley's been focused on Central America and avoiding those dickheads up on Capitol Hill. I told you about our operative that got snatched off the streets of Beirut a few months back. Well, that's not the first time that's happened. We got soft in the '80s and let these assholes get away with way too much shit.
Glancing at Rapp's face in the mirror, he said, April of 83, our embassy gets hit. 63 people killed. Langley lost 8 of its best people that day, including our nearest director and station chief. Hurley left out the fact that he had been in the city that day, that he could have easily been one of the victims. He also left out the fact that Kennedy's dad was one of the men they'd lost. It was not his place to share something so personal. If she wanted to tell them one day, that was her business.
Our response? We send in the Marines. October of 83, the Marines and French forces get hit by a couple of truck bombs. 299 men wasted because a bunch of fucking diplomats conned the command element into thinking too much security would send the wrong message. Mind you, not a single one of those dilettante pricks ever spent a day in that godforsaken city. Our response after the barracks bombing? We say, we're not going to leave. We drop a few bombs, and we leave.
Hurley swore to himself.
And they get it in their heads that they can fuck with us and get away scot-free. March of 84, they grab my old buddy Bill Buckley, our new station chief, Korean and Vietnam War vet, amazing guy.
Hurley looked out the window for a moment with sadness in his eyes.
They tortured him for almost a year and a half. Flew him over to Tehran. The bastards taped it. I've seen parts.
Hurley shook his head as if trying to get rid of a bad thought.
They sucked every last drop of information out of him, and then they sold it to the Russians and anyone else who was interested. Bill knew a lot of shit. The info they got from him did a boatload of damage. I can't even begin to tell you how many nights I've lain awake wondering how I would have handled it. They brought in a so-called expert, a Hezbollah shrink by the name of Aziz Al-Aboub, trained by the Russians at the People's Friendship University. The names these assholes come up with just boggles the mind. Al-Aboub pumped him full of drugs and poked and prodded. The word is he had two assistants who helped him. They turned it into a real science project. Bill's heart eventually gave out. But not before they extracted some of our most closely held secrets. One by one, assets started to disappear. Highly placed sources and governments around the region and beyond. And how do we react? We didn't do jack shit. And the result was they became more emboldened. Gaddafi, that quack, then decides to plant a bomb in a disco in Berlin, and finally we decide to hit back and drop a few bombs on his head. Unfortunately, we missed. And then in July of 88, that cowboy captain of the Vincennes decided he's going to start racing all over the Strait of Hormuz, chasing $10,000 fiberglass gunboats with a $500 million Aegis-guided missile cruiser.
Hurley had to stop and close his eyes, as if he still couldn't believe that ugly piece of history. Rapp finished it for him. Iran Air Flight 655. 290 civilians.
Yep,
Hurley said, realizing that having lost his girlfriend later that same year, Rapp would know the story.
Not our proudest moment. I don't care what anyone tries to tell you, that one was our fault. Instead of owning up to it and using it as an opportunity to show the Iranian people that we weren't out to get them, we denied the entire thing. Went so far as to blame it on them. Now, they weren't without fault, but that captain had two choppers on board to deal with those gunboats. The strength of the Aegis cruiser is distance. You don't close with the enemy to use your World War II-era guns. If there's really a threat, you back off and fire one of your missiles.
And that's what led us to Pan Am Lockerbie, Rapp said. Hurley nodded.
It's a little more complicated than that, but in a nutshell, yeah.
So, Richard said, we fit in how?
Let's just say some people in Washington have seen the error of their ways. This terrorism, especially the Islamic radical shit, has some people spooked, and it should. They saw what happened last time when we allowed someone like Buckley to get snatched without lifting a finger. It gives people the wrong idea. Now the schnoz has been grabbed, and is starting all over again. I'm not supposed to tell you guys this, but what the fuck? 5 of our sources have been killed in just the last few months. We've had to recall another dozen plus. We're flying blind, and once again, by doing nothing,
We've reinforced the idea that they can do whatever they want to us, and we won't lift a finger.
And the stuff you've been working on all night. How does that fit in? Rapp asked.
Let's suppose for a second that you have $5 million sitting in a Swiss bank account. That money represents years of extortion, drug and gun running, counterfeiting, and a host of illegal scams. You've worked yourself to the bone squirreling away this money. What would you do if you woke up one morning and found out that account, your account, was empty?
Rapp looked at the winding road and said, I'd flip.
You think you might pick up the phone and start demanding some answers?
Yeah.
Damn right you would. Right now these pricks are sleeping soundly in their beds, thinking their money is safe in Switzerland. At some point in the next 24 hours, they're going to find out that their ill-gotten gains have vanished, and they are going to pick up the phone, and they are going to go absolutely apeshit. And when they do, Hurley pointed skyward, we will be listening.
Chapter 35. Zurich, Switzerland. As promised by Hurley, the border crossing was uneventful. Doer, serious Anglos in nice suits, in a nice car, crossing from one efficient European country into an even more efficient European country. They continued to wind their way toward the banking capital of the world as the sun climbed in the sky and Hurley explained in more detail what they were up to. After another 40 minutes, they arrived on the outskirts of Zurich. Hurley told Rapp which exit to take and where to turn. A few minutes later, they pulled up to the gates of an estate.
What's this, an embassy? Rapp asked.
No, Hurley said, smiling. The home of an old friend.
The car had barely come to a stop when the heavy black and gold gate began to open. Rapp eased the sedan slowly up the crushed rock drive. The garden beds were bare, and the manicured arborvitae wrapped in burlap to protect them from the heavy, wet snows that were common this time of year. The place must have been magnificent in the summer. The house reminded him of some of the abodes of foreign ambassadors that dotted the countryside west of D.C. Hurley had him pull the car around the back, where one of 6 garage doors was open, the stall empty, anticipating their arrival. Karl Ohlmeyer was waiting for them in his library. The man was tall, thin, and regal. At first glance, he was more British-looking than German, but his thick accent washed that thought from Rapp's mind almost as quickly as it had appeared. He was dressed impeccably in a 3-piece suit. Hurley had given them the man's brief history. They had met in their 20s in Berlin. Ohlmeyer had been fortunate enough to survive World War II, but unfortunate in that his family farm was 21 miles east of Berlin rather than west. He had received his primary education at the hands of Jesuit priests who had drilled into him the idea that God expected you to better yourself every day. Luke 12:28 was a big one. For of those to whom much is given, much is required. Since Ohlmeyer was a gifted mathematician, much was expected of him. When he was 16, the Russian tanks came down the same dirt road that the German tanks had gone down only a few years before, but going in the opposite direction, of course. And with them, they brought a cloud of death and destruction. 2 years later, he enrolled as a freshman at the prestigious Humboldt University in the Russian-controlled sector of Berlin. Over the next 3 years, he watched in silence as fellow students and professors were arrested by the Russian secret police and shipped off to Siberia to do hard time for daring to speak out against the tenets of communism. The once grand university, which had educated statesmen like Bismarck, philosophers like Hegel, and physicists like Einstein, had become nothing more than a rotted-out shell. Buildings that had been partially destroyed during the war sat untouched the entire time he was there. All the while in the West, the Americans, British and French, were busy rebuilding. Ohlmeyer saw communism for the sham that it was, a bunch of brutes who seized power in the name of the people only to repress the very people they claimed to champion. Hurley recited for them Ohlmeyer's stalwart claim that any form of government that required the repression, imprisonment, and execution of those who disagreed with it was certainly not a government of the people. But in those days following the war, when so many millions had been killed, people were in no mood for another fight. So Ohlmeyer kept quiet and bided his time, and then after he received his degree in economics, he fled to the American sector. A few years later, while he was working at a bank, he ran into a brash young American who hated the communists even more than he did. His name was Stanley Albertus Hurley, and they struck up a friendship that went far beyond a casual contempt for communism. Ohlmeyer, upon seeing Hurley, dropped any pretense of formality and rushed out from behind his desk. He took Hurley's hand in both of his and began berating his friend in German. Hurley gave it right back. After a brief exchange, Ohlmeyer looked at the other two men and in English said, "Are these the two you told me about?" Hurley nodded. "Yep, these are Mike and Pat." "Yes, I'm sure you are." Ohlmeyer smiled and extended his hand, not believing their names were Mike and Pat for a second. "I can't tell you how exciting it is to meet you. Stan has told me you are two of the best he has seen in years." Ohlmeyer instantly read the looks of surprise on the faces of the two young men. With mock surprise of his own, he turned to Hurley and said, "Was I not supposed to say anything?" Hurley looked far from enthused over his friend's talkativeness. "You will have to excuse my old confidant," Ohlmeyer said, putting a hand on Hurley's shoulder. "He finds it extremely difficult to express feelings of admiration and warmth. That way he doesn't feel as bad when he beats you over the head." Rapp and Richard started laughing. Hurley didn't. "Please make yourself comfortable. There is coffee and tea and juice over there on the table and fresh rolls. If you require anything else, do not hesitate to ask. Stan and I have some work to do, but it shouldn't take too long. Then I suggest all of you get some sleep. You will be staying for dinner tonight, no?" Ohlmeyer turned to Hurley for the answer. "I hope." "Nonsense, you are staying." Hurley hated to commit to things. "I'd like to, but who knows what might pop up after this morning." "True, and I will have my plane ready to take you wherever you need to go tomorrow morning. You are staying for dinner, that is final. There's much we need to catch up on, and besides, I need to tell these two young men of our exploits."
"That might not be such a good idea."
"Nonsense!" Ohlmeyer dismissed Hurley's concern as completely inconsequential. He looked down at the briefcase in Hurley's hand. With a devilish look, he asked, "Did you bring the codes?"
"No, I drove all the way from Hamburg just so I could stare at your ugly mug. Of course I brought them."
Ohlmeyer started laughing heartily before turning to Rapp and Richards. "Have you ever met a grumpier man in your entire life?"
"Nope,"
Rapp said without hesitation, while Richards simply shook his head. While Rapp and Richards retired to the other end of the 40-foot-long study to get some food, Ohlmeyer and Hurley were joined by two men whom Rapp guessed to be in their mid-40s. They looked like businessmen, probably bankers. The four of them huddled around Ohlmeyer's massive desk, while the silver-haired German issued explicit instructions in German. 40 minutes later, the two men left, each carrying several pages of instructions. At 9:05, they received the anticlimactic call that the 17 accounts had been drained of all funds. But that was just the beginning. Over the next 3 hours, the computers continued to execute transfers. Each account was divided into 3 new accounts and then split again by 3 until there were 153 new accounts. The money had been flung far and wide, from offshore accounts in Cyprus, Malaysia, and Hong Kong, and across the Caribbean. Each transfer ate away at the balance as the various banks charged their fees, but Hurley didn't care. He was playing with someone else's money. The important thing was to leave a trail that would be impossible to untangle. With all the different jurisdictions and separate privacy laws, it would take an army of lawyers a lifetime to slash through the mess. By noon, the number of accounts had shrunk to 5, with a net balance of $38 million. Chapter 36. Beirut, Lebanon. Syed's lungs and thighs ached as he climbed the crumbling concrete stairs. His week had gone from miserable to intolerable, starting with his trip to Moscow and ending with his superiors in Damascus issuing one of the most idiotic orders he had received in all of his professional career. With the ceasefire finally looking as if it was going to take hold, the cursed Maronites had decided to accelerate their land grab. Their focus, it appeared, was the historically important area known as Martyrs Square in Beirut's central district. Damascus ordered Syed to get to the square, plant his flag, and plant it as quickly as possible. Like some battlefield general who had been ordered to hold a piece of land at all costs and then Given no support, Syed was left to sort out the how. 15 years in this city had taught him the importance of keeping a healthy distance between himself and the other factions. Rifles and machine guns were nasty things, and placed in the hands of teenage boys, they were extremely unpredictable. The idea of taking up one side of the square while the Maronites grabbed the other made his skin crawl. One errant shot, one young, crazy Eastern Catholic who wanted to avenge the death of a brother or the rape of a sister could plunge the entire city back into war. Orders, unfortunately, were orders, and as much as he would have liked to, he could not ignore them. So Syed sent Samir and Ali to choose an adequate building, and while he was contemplating how to fill it with enough men to deter the Maronites, he was struck with an ingenious solution. Svietz would be coming from Moscow to collect the CIA agent in just a few days. That would leave him with the American businessman Zachary Austin. He was not an agent of any sort, Syed was sure of that. The only question that remained was how much they could get for him and how that money would be split with that fool Abu Radi. The Fatah gunman had been crying like a little girl over the fact that he'd been forced to surrender the telecommunications executive. If Syed brought him in, it would be seen as a great gesture of maturity and goodwill by the others. And maybe he could negotiate it in such a way that he could get the Fatah rats to come hold the entire western end of the square. The two had sat down over tea the previous afternoon. Radi had brought no fewer than 12 men, a ridiculous number for the current level of tension. Syed first explained the situation with the Maronites moving into Martyr Square. He was hoping that the emotionally charged piece of land would spur Radi to action, and he was not disappointed. The man was so eager to show his passion for the cause that he leaped at the chance to hold the western half of the square. Without so much as seeking a concession in return, he pledged 50 men to the operation. The number surprised even Syed, and he was tempted to hold back his offer to hand over the American. Radi was an emotional fool to commit so much without gaining a single concession, but Syed had a problem. He couldn't very well hold the west side of the square and leave the 2 Americans in the basement of the office over on Hamra Street with only a few men guarding them. He had served 3 years in the army before joining the General Security Directorate, and he recalled something they'd told him in infantry school about consolidating your forces. It would only be for a few days until the Russians could pick up the CIA spy. After that, Syed didn't really care what happened to the businessman, just so long as he got his share of the ransom. Syed looked across the small bistro table and said, "I have finished interrogating the businessman from Texas." "So, is he a spy?" Radi asked. "No. I am certain he is in fact a businessman." "Good. Then I can commence negotiations for his release." Syed did not speak. He waited for Radi to make him an offer. The same arrangement they'd had in the past. "I will guarantee you 20% of the ransom." Syed was tempted to ask for 50. The others would likely back him, but he needed Radi's help with the Maronite problem. "I think 30 would be fair, considering everything else." Before Radi could counter, Syed said, "I will bring him to the new building tonight along with the other American. It can be your new command post for a few weeks." It was an honor Radi would never be able to refuse. He would be considered the vanguard in the struggle to reclaim the city from the Christians. The building itself would have to eventually be destroyed. It listed at a 5-degree angle toward the square and looked as if a strong wind might topple all 7 stories into the street. But it was built out of sturdy concrete and would have to be blown up before it would fall. Of all the buildings that bordered the square, it was perhaps the 2nd strongest position. Unfortunately, the Maronites had the best position, no more than 300 feet directly across from them. Radi had already made 1 mistake, and Syed blamed himself for it. The self-promoter had left his sprawling slums near the airport in a 10-vehicle convoy and arranged for the peasants to send him and his men off as if they were valiant Muslims on a mission to evict the Crusaders. Instead of a quiet arrival, they had pulled into the square flying the bright yellow Fatah flag. The chances for escalation were now ripe. That was not Syed's preference. The last thing he needed with Svetz coming to pick up the CIA man was open conflict. The prisoners had arrived the previous evening, transferred in just two cars. The proper way, very low-key. And then, for the next few hours, men and supplies were slowly transferred over from the office on Humra Street. They had successfully moved the bulk of their stuff without tipping their hand. And then, in one fell swoop, with a gesture of egotistical grandeur, Radi had announced to the entire city that they were staking out their turf. While that might accomplish the short-term goals of Damascus, it also might plunge the city back into chaos. As Syed reached the roof, he realized that it also might get him killed. He peered around the corner with his left eye and looked across the street. The Maronite building was one story taller, and with a glance he counted no fewer than five heads and three muzzles along the roofline. It had just been reported to him that they were filling sandbags and barricading the windows and doors on the first floor. Of course they were. That's what he would do, and was in fact doing. It would be really nice if they could get through this little standoff without a shot being fired, because if just one shot was fired, the entire square would erupt in a fusillade of lead projectiles. He'd seen it happen before. Literally, thousands of rounds would be exchanged in minutes. He would have to remember to tell the men to keep their weapons on safe. Syed found Samir around the other side of the blockhouse at the top of the building. It was the place most shielded from the position across the street. Samir handed Syed the satellite phone that Ivanov's effeminate deputy had given him before Syed left Moscow. "Hello," he said as he placed it to his ear.
"My friend, how are things?"
Syed frowned. It was Ivanov, and he sounded as if he was drunk. It was only mid-afternoon. "Fine," Syed said as he stole a quick look around the corner. The sun had reflected off something across the street, and he got the horrible feeling it was the front end of a sniper's scope.
"How are things in your fine city?"
Syed pulled the phone away from his ear and looked at it with skepticism. Something was wrong with Ivanov. The man hated Beirut. He sighed and put the phone back to his ear. "A little tense at the moment, but nothing I can't handle."
"What is wrong?"
"Just a land grab by one of the other militias. It has created a bit of a standoff."
"Fellow Muslims?"
"No," Syed said, irritated by the implication. Ivanov liked to get drunk and lecture him on history. Specifically, that Muslims loved nothing more than to kill each other, and the only time they stopped killing each other was when they decided to kill Jews, Hindus, or Christians. "Maronites."
"Ah, the wood ticks of the Middle East. Haven't you been trying to exterminate them for 1,000 years?
"What do you want?"
"My package," Ivanov said, slurring the words. "Is it ready? You haven't decided to negotiate with the Persians, have you?"
"I am standing by our deal. When can I expect it to be retrieved? I assume you are still sending someone?"
"Yes, although I am considering coming myself."
There was a long pause, and then,
"You did offer, didn't you?"
"Oh," Syed said, surprised that Ivanov was taking him up on his insincere offer. "Absolutely."
"Good. I will be there in 3 days, maybe sooner."
"Fantastic," Syed lied. "I will have everything prepared. I must go now. There is something urgent I need to attend to. Please call if you need anything else." Syed punched the red button and disconnected the call. He looked around the desolate landscape, with its pancaked and shelled-out buildings, and wondered how he could ever play host to Ivanov in this pile of rubble. Then, as he turned to go down the stairs, he came face to face with Imad Mughniyeh, the co-leader of Islamic Jihad. Mughniyeh, not known for levity, looked as if he was ready to kill someone. "Imad," Syed said, "what is wrong?" Mughniyeh looked back into the stairwell and motioned for his two bodyguards to give him some privacy. "Who was that?" he said, looking at the phone. "I heard you talking."
"Ivanov. What did he want?"
"To insult me, I think, but I did not take the bait."
"Anything else?"
"He was going to send one of his men to pick up the spy. Now he's changed his mind and he's going to come himself."
He just changed his mind. Right now?
Yes, Syed said, wondering what all the questions were about. What is wrong? Mugniya again looked over his shoulder to make sure no one would hear him. In a raspy voice, he said,
My bank accounts. In Switzerland. They are empty.
What do you mean, empty?
Empty, gone, nothing.
Syed knew there must have been a mistake.
Impossible. I have checked 3 times already, and it is not only the 2 Islamic Jihad accounts. My personal account you helped me set up is also empty.
There was a hint of accusation in his words.
This can't be. There has to be a mistake. Have you called Hamburg?
Mugniya nodded.
My cousin tried 6 different times today.
Did he get hold of Dorfman?
He shook his head. Herr Dorfman is dead.
Dead?
Killed in his own home. Last night.
Syed's knees felt weak. He was the one who had suggested Dorfman to Mugniya and the others.
You are the only one of us who knew this banker. You specifically said we would never regret investing our money with him.
Syed could see where this was going. They would need to blame someone, and he was the easiest target.
Are you sure he's dead? As sure as I can be from here.
Syed didn't like the way the Islamic Jihad's heavy was looking at him.
We will get to the bottom of this. I promise you I had nothing to do with this. Come with me, Syed said, wanting to get off the roof lest Mugniya decide to throw him off.
We'll go to my bank here in town. I'm sure there has been a mistake. I had money with him as well.
Tell me again, what is the connection with Dorfman?
Syed had already reached the first landing. He stopped dead in his tracks and looked at Mugniya.
Ivanov introduced me to him 6 years ago. And he just called you? And mentioned none of this?
Not a word.
Fucking Russians. Always scheming.
Chapter 37. Zurich, Switzerland. Rapp and Richards missed most of the excitement. With the time change and lack of sleep over the past few days, both of them took Ohlmeyer up on his offer of a room. Rapp had just enough energy in him to slip out of his suit and pull back the covers, but not enough to brush his teeth or anything else. He didn't even bother to close the curtains. He did a face plant on the big king-size bed and was out cold. He could do that sometimes, just lie down on his stomach, close his eyes, and it was goodnight, Irene. The only problem came when he woke up. Lying on his face like that caused his sinuses to drain and blood to pool around his eyes. His arms were pinned beneath him. He cracked one eye and thought of the ultimate yin and yang, life and death. He wondered if it was normal to think about it so much, or if he should bring it up to Lewis when he made it back stateside. That was if he made it back. That thought brought a smile to his face. He had no idea why he found it amusing that someone might kill him, but he did. Probably because there was a better than even chance that whoever the man was, he had no idea the kind of fight he was in for. Rapp didn't discuss it with anyone, not even Lewis or Kennedy, but was good at this kind of work, and he was getting better. At 23, he was already intimately familiar with death. There was his father, and then Mary, and now less than a week ago he'd stared into the eyes of a man and pulled the trigger. And his life drained from the man's face. He had felt nothing. At least not guilt or sorrow or nerves. It was as if a calm had passed over him. And then last night, the bizarre home invasion of Herr Dorfman, when he'd signed on with Kennedy, he hadn't had that type of thing in mind. Killing a man in the manner that he'd killed Sharif, he'd dreamed of at least 1,000 times. Dorfman? Never. Never once had his fertile imagination predicted that he would see a man shot in the head while he clutched his prized poodle. Without warning or any real conscious decision, he jumped out of bed, assumed the position, and started doing push-ups. He thought of the old saying, if you're not busy living, you're dying. It felt good to be living. He ripped through 50 push-ups, flipped over, and did 50 sit-ups, and then decided he needed to take a run. He dug out his gear. It was 4:37 in the afternoon.
His running shoes were virtually brand new, as the last pair had been stuffed in a garbage can in Istanbul. With a house this big, Rapp assumed they had to have a workout room. He was right. A staff member must have heard him coming down the stairs and met him in the foyer. He escorted Rapp back upstairs, down the hallway, past his room, to the far wing of the house. The room had windows on three sides, a treadmill, a bike, and a rowing machine, as well as a universal machine and some dumbbells. Rapp got up on the treadmill, picked the mountain course, and hit start. For the next 30 minutes the ramp rose and fell, and all the while he kept a 6-minute pace. When the digital readout told him he'd run 5 miles, he punched the red stop button and jumped off, his chest heaving, sweat dripping from his face. He didn't even have enough left for a cool-down. As he stood hunched over, his hands on his knees, he wondered for a brief moment if he might vomit. And that was when she walked into the room. Rapp stood up straight, a pained look on his face, and tried to take in a full breath. "Here you are," she said in near-perfect English. "I've been looking all over for you." Rapp could hardly conceal his surprise. Here, standing before him, was possibly the most attractive woman he'd ever laid eyes on. And she was looking for him. Still out of breath, he started to speak, but stopped. The nausea came back, and he decided rather quickly that he needed to open one of the windows, or he really was going to vomit in front of this beauty. He held up a single finger and said, "Excuse me." Rapp cranked one of the windows open and took in the fresh, cold air. A couple of deep breaths later, the nausea began to pass. "Sorry," he said as he turned back around. "I'm a little out of shape." The blonde beauty placed a hand on her hip and gave him an appraising look. "I don't see anything wrong with your shape." Rapp laughed nervously and, not knowing how to respond, said, "You look great, too. I mean, you don't look like you need to work out, is what I mean." That's what came out of his mouth. Inside his brain, he was screaming at himself, "You're a moron." "Thank you," she flashed him a perfect set of white teeth. That was when Rapp noticed the dimple on her chin. Her overall looks had knocked him so off kilter that he was just now getting around to categorizing her individual features. Blue eyes, platinum blonde hair, pulled back in a high ponytail, prominent cheekbones, like some Nordic goddess. Weren't these people all related somehow? A tiny little upturned nose, the dimple on the chin, though, that had caught his attention for some reason. "My grandfather sent me to find you." That was where he had seen it. Herr Ohlmeyer had that same dimple, or cleft, or whatever it was that they called it. Somehow it looked much better on her. Rapp smiled and offered his hand. "Mike, get hold of yourself," his brain screamed at him. "Greta, pleased to meet you." The smile made him a bit wobbly in the knees. "Of course you are," Rapp thought to himself. The image of Greta in pigtails and lederhosen with a white blouse and ample cleavage holding a couple of beer steins flashed across his mind. "What the hell is wrong with me?" He noticed her face muscles tighten a bit, and then she looked down at their still clasped hands. "Oh, I'm sorry," Rapp said as he released her hand. He hustled over to the shelf where the towels were and grabbed her one. Instead of giving it to her, he began mopping her hand. "I'm so sorry." She laughed nervously and took the towel from him. "My grandfather wanted me to tell you drinks are being served at 6 sharp in the library. Jacket and tie are required. His rules, not mine." "Okay," Rapp replied, and then, feeling some irrational need to keep talking, he asked, "What are you wearing?" She crinkled up her nose and said, "You are funny." And then she was gone. In stunned silence, Rapp watched her leave. He didn't know how it was possible, but she looked every bit as good from behind. She was in a pair of jeans that were tucked into brown leather riding boots. The door closed with a click that snapped Rapp out of his trance. He slapped himself in the head twice. "What are you, 15? You moron!" He tried to finish the workout, but his mind wasn't in it. So he went back to his room, took a cold shower, and thought about Greta. Romance, companionship, call it whatever you want. It wasn't something he had put a lot of thought into since losing Mary. He'd had a few flings here and there, but they were purely physical. They all wanted to fix him, that was the problem. They knew who he was and that he'd lost his high school sweetheart in the attack that had so devastated Syracuse. Being the captain of a national championship lacrosse team at a school that was crazy about the sport virtually guaranteed that a certain number of women would end up in his lap. Unfortunately, they eventually wanted to talk about his feelings about how he was coping with the loss and heartache. Nothing could have been more unappealing to him. His feelings, his personal agony, were no one else's business. It had been almost 4 years now. Maybe that was what was going on. Time really was healing the wound. Or maybe it was Sharif and Dorfman. Maybe tossing their bodies down that big hollow pit in the back of his mind had helped stay the pain. Or maybe it was simply the fact that Greta was so stunning. She'd blinded him into forgetting his past for a moment. No, that couldn't have been it, at least not all of it. He'd met plenty of gorgeous women the past few years, and none of them had hit him with this kind of lightning bolt. Rapp knotted his tie in the mirror and decided to leave the question there. It was a riddle, an unsolved problem, more than likely all the above or some of the above. And what did it really matter? He'd felt something he hadn't felt in years and wasn't sure he would ever feel again. The spark of a crush or love at first sight, he had no idea. He had a hard time buying the latter. More than likely, it was simple lust. Two young, attractive people, their pheromones in overdrive. Was there a chance she felt the same thing? He recalled the look she'd given him as she gave him the once-over. Staring at his reflection, he asked, "What does any of it matter? I'm leaving in the morning, going on safari." Rapp cinched the Windsor knot just so, and decided to enjoy the evening. He would forget about yesterday and tomorrow, the pain and the obligations, and just try to live like a normal person. For one night. Chapter 38. Moscow, Russia. Ivanov placed the handset back in the cradle and reached for the glass of vodka. It was snatched from his grasp a split second before his hand got there, his fingers closed and found air. He blinked several times before looking up and seeing Shvets holding the glass. "Mine," was all he could manage to say. Shvets wanted to tell him he spoke like a toddler when he was drunk, but it would do no good at this point. "What did he say?"
"He has no idea."
"You're sure?" Shvets should have listened on the extension. When his boss got like this, he was extremely unreliable.
"What's there to be sure about?"
He pushed himself away from his desk and leaned back in his high back leather chair.
"The man is a camel jockey. He is not smart enough to steal this money from us."
Shvets would have loved nothing more at this exact moment than to tell his alcoholic boss that Syed was smarter than him, but he'd seen him shoot people for such insolence.
"I should go to Hamburg?"
"No, I need you here. Send Pavel."
Now, there was an idiot, Shvets thought. Pavel Sokol was fine with numbers and balance sheets, but borderline retarded when it came to everything else in life. Sending him to Hamburg would get them nowhere. "We need answers, and I'm afraid sitting here will not get us any. Sending Pavel will only add to the confusion. You won't allow me to discuss this with anyone other than you or Pavel, so getting those answers is going to be very difficult.
But I need you here."
"There will be no here in a few days," he said with some force. "Once word gets out that the money is missing, the phone will start ringing, and sooner or later it will be kicked upstairs, or worse, across town, and once that happens, they will pull you in."
"Us! You mean us!" he half screamed. "Your wagon is hitched to mine. Trust me, a minute doesn't pass that I don't think of it. And I have been good to you."
"Yes, you have," Shvets said half-heartedly.
"And I will continue to take care of you. We just need some answers."
"What we need is money," he said, trying to get Ivanov to see the fundamental problem. "Answers might lead us to the money, but we will not get those answers sitting here in Moscow."
"Stop speaking in riddles."
"Just let me go to Hamburg and see what I can find out. I will fly out tonight, and if all goes well, I'll be back on the first flight in the morning."
"And what am I going to do?"
Shvets's solution was suddenly very clear.
"Go out and get drunk.
Order up some women, and go to Hotel Balchug.
Ivanov frowned. He was in no mood to socialize.
You must keep up appearances. You know how this town is. If rumors start that you are in trouble and no one sees you in public, they will believe the rumors. If they see you out acting as if everything is normal, they won't believe the rumors.
Schietz was willing to say almost anything to convince him. Sitting here in this office was getting them nowhere. He'd seen his boss in these funks before, usually only for a day or two. Always a pity party, but somehow the heaps of despair and recrimination eventually focused him, and he came out of it like a bear ready to charge. And when that happened, Schietz had better have a better understanding of what had happened, or he could end up being the casualty. He suggested, "Bring Alexei and Ivan. They will make sure you are taken care of."
"Yes," Ivanov thought, "my two Luka brasses. No one would dare challenge me with them as my companions."
Ivanov felt better just thinking of his two loyal soldiers, and besides, some flesh might be the remedy for his dismal attitude. And he wanted a drink.
"Fine," he relented, "but I want you to call me as soon as you hear something."
Schietz turned tentative. They'd done enough talking on the phones today, and in this new era of electronic surveillance, there was no telling who was listening.
"I promise," he lied, as he started for the door. "And remember, act like nothing has changed tonight."
Chapter 39. Zurich, Switzerland. Rapp entered the study a few minutes before 6, and found Hurley alone, a phone in his left hand and a drink in his right, staring out the French doors at the snow-capped mountains in the distance. Hurley glanced casually over his shoulder, the phone pressed against his left ear, to see who it was, and then went back to what he was doing. Rapp glided across the room, stepping from the hardwood floor onto a large Persian rug. The library was on 2 levels. The second floor consisted of a catwalk that accessed the stacks of books lining the 4 walls. There wasn't a dust jacket on a single book. A large wood-paneled door to Rapp's left opened with a click. Herr Ohlmeyer appeared, a warm smile on his face. He held up one of his long fingers and silently motioned for Rapp to join him. Rapp glanced at Hurley to see if the man wanted to discuss anything, but he was still on the phone, so he followed Ohlmeyer into a much smaller, windowless office. Something about the room felt different, off in some way. When Ohlmeyer closed the door, there was a click of finality and then near total silence. Only the faint hum of a CPU. Rapp became aware of his own breathing and then realized the room was soundproof. The floor was elevated a few inches, and the walls and ceiling were built in and covered in fabric. Behind the desk, with the triple screens, was a bank of black-and-white security monitors, 3 high and 5 across. In front of the desk was a small conference table, maybe 48 inches across. It had 4 bland wood chairs. The room was such a stark contrast to the rest of the house that Rapp couldn't help but take notice. Ohlmeyer could see the younger man's interest and said, "In my business one must take certain precautions." He pulled out one of the chairs, told Rapp to sit, and then grabbed a file from his desk. Placing it on the conference table, he said, "I admire what you are doing. This is not an easy life you have chosen." Rapp nodded in a noncommittal way, but other than that, did not respond. "Do you have any regrets so far?" Without hesitation, Rapp said, "No. No problems sleeping, no second thoughts. I'm not a big sleeper." Ohlmeyer smiled and scratched the dimple on his chin. "Your type rarely is."
"My type?"
"Yes, the hunter. It is imprinted in your genetic code. Almost everyone has it, dormant for thousands of years. In many, there isn't enough of it left to do them any good. They spend their days in sedentary jobs that challenge them neither physically or mentally. They do not have your abilities and your drive, of course."
Rapp supposed there was a good deal of truth in his words. He simply had not put a lot of time into thinking about it.
"I have some documents here," Ohlmeyer said as he tapped the file. "Stan knows about this, but he does not want to know the details."
"Details?" Rapp asked, wondering what Hurley was up to now.
"You are in a very dangerous line of work. You are but a small vessel in a harbor packed with giant
supertankers. Those supertankers bump up against each other sometimes, causing little harm to themselves, but to you, it is the end.
He clapped his hands together, signifying the destruction of Rapp's boat.
In your work, you need a special kind of insurance. And do you know why?
Rapp could hazard a guess, but he got the idea Holmeyer would prefer to do the talking.
Not really. Because those supertankers don't really care about you. They may lament your misfortune, but only briefly. The tanker, the ego of the captain, all comes before you. Think of it as the ship of state, if you will. You are young, and if you are lucky, your career will last for another 4 decades. During that time, your handlers will come and go, and the political winds of change will reverse directions more times than you will be able to count. And sooner or later, it is likely that someone within your own government will begin to think of you as a problem. Ships of state do not like to be embarrassed. And if that means sinking a small vessel every once in a while, well, that is a price they are willing to pay.
Rapp had a bad feeling. He looked at the file and said, "What's that all about?"
"It is your insurance policy."
Holmeyer opened the file and clipped to the first sheaf of documents was a Swiss passport.
"Stan has assured me that your French is perfect."
Rapp nodded.
"And your Italian, German, and Arabic?"
"My Italian is good, my German is weak, and my Arabic is pretty good." Holmeyer nodded. That matched with what Hurley had told him.
"I have prepared 3 separate legends for you. Swiss,"
he slid the set of documents out of the file, followed by 2 more.
"French and Italian. You will need to memorize everything in these files, and, most important, you will need to visit Paris and Milan in the coming weeks."
"Why?"
"You now own a safety deposit box in each city, and one in Zurich, but I will take care of that one for you. You will want to place certain things in these safety deposit boxes, things that will help you survive should you need to go underground, as they say."
Rapp frowned. "Does Stan know about this?"
"It was his idea. Mine as well, but we did the same thing for him years ago."
He slid over a blank sheet of paper with 3 names on it. The first 2 were French, and the 3rd was Italian.
"Please practice signing each of these a few times before I have you sign the signature cards."
Rapp took the pen and began practicing the name Paul Girard.
"Why isn't Stan handling this?"
"He does not want to know the details."
"Why?"
"Because every man in your profession needs a few secrets."
"Even from his own boss and government?"
"Especially from your boss and your government."
Rapp was wondering how he was going to keep all of these different aliases straight. Hurley had already given him 2, and here were 3 more. He practiced a few times on the other names and then signed the cards.
"In each box," Holmeyer said, "will be $20,000 in cash, various documents such as birth certificates in case you lose the passport, and a matching set of credit cards and driver's license. As I said, you will want to add certain things to each box, but you should talk to Stan about that. There's also a numbered account here in Switzerland that I will be administering."
"A numbered account?" Rapp said, barely able to conceal his surprise.
"Yes, Stan has requested that as well, and told me that it is up to my discretion to release the funds."
Rapp was tempted to ask the size of the account, but instead said, "May I ask you a personal question?" Holmeyer nodded with a smile, as if he already knew the question. "Why are you doing this? Helping us?"
"We will discuss it over dinner tonight, but the short answer is that I believe in freedom."
"Freedom," Rapp said as he turned the word over in his mind for a second. "That's a pretty vague term."
"Not really. But if it helps you understand my motivation, you'll need to understand that I grew up in East Germany. I saw what the Soviets were really like."
Rapp's mind was filled with a menagerie of black and white atrocities, courtesy of the World at War shows he saw as kid. "So you hate the Russians?" Holmeyer gave a little laugh and said,
"Let's just say I believe in good guys and bad guys."
Chapter 40. Hamburg, Germany. By early afternoon, they learned that Dorfman was dead. The news sent Ivanov into a fit of rage. He went on for a good 5 minutes, ranting that he had never tried